My name is Roman Dial, and I've spent my life exploring remote wilderness. My only son followed me in my footsteps. But on his first solo expedition through the jungles of Central America, he vanished without a trace. I've launched an independent investigation to find out what happened to my son, Cody Roman Dial. You don't know pain until you've lost a child. You don't know agony until your son has gone missing, and no one can tell you what's happened.
Cody said, I'm gonna be back by this time. And so I got sick to my stomach. I knew something was up.
Hello, and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clementi, former New York City prosecutor, retired FBI profiler, and currently writer and producer on CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today is...
Laura Richards. I'm a criminal behavioral analyst, and I'm also founder and director of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I am the casting director for Criminal Minds and Beyond Borders.
Well, today we have two very extra special guests, and we're going to be talking about a show called Missing Dial. And the stars of that show are Carson Ulrich and Ken Fournier, both former federal operators and currently people who consult on cases of missing persons and other, let's say, critical incidents. So I want to introduce you to first Carson Ulrich. How you doing,
how
Carson?
Are you?
Good.
Hey, Jim, how are you doing?
Good. It's good to have you with us today. And
thank you.
Ken Fournier.
Hey, gang.
How you doing?
Good. I'm doing great.
Well, would you guys each like to tell a little bit about your backgrounds, and then we'll get into the show?
Yeah, sure. I was a special agent in the Drug Enforcement Administration for 25 years. And my last assignment was with a program called FAST, which is the Foreign Deployed Advisory and Support Teams. And those are teams that are, they're designed to work in a tactical environment, but some of the more austere environments, Central and South America, Haiti, and Afghanistan as well.
Great.
And I spent most of my career in Latin America in the DEA, simping to a number of schools and taught me how to speak Spanish, where I was expected to do my job in Spanish.
And I've got to say, that was very impressive, actually, Carson, seeing you're Missing Dial and being fluent in Spanish and going into these places and being able to communicate on their terms and their level and their language.
Well, thank you.
And Ken Fournier, wanted to tell us about your background.
Yeah, I'm Ken Fournier. I spent 14 years as an Air Force pararescueman, another 14 years after that as an independent contractor for certain government agencies overseas all around the world. As a PJ, we were pretty much trained to go into any environment there is to rescue people in whatever situation they find themselves in.
Thank you. And because of that, these are the two guys that my brother Tim and I, who own XG Productions, recommended when This Is Just a Test Productions came to us and said, there's a case of a boy named Cody Roman Dial who went hiking into the jungles of Costa Rica and disappeared about 2 years ago. Now, his father, Roman Dial, is a world-renowned explorer. And he's used to extreme environments, and he actually trained his son in dealing with and hiking through and living in and surviving in extreme environments. And the fact is that it's very unusual for somebody with those skill sets to actually just go missing. So Roman Dial, when he got the last communication from his son and then didn't hear anything else, formed a search party and went down there and with the Red Cross and with Costa Rican authorities, did extensive searches in the jungle in very, very dangerous places and was unable to find any hint at all of what happened to Coast. So a year later, we put together this co-production between This Is Just a Test and XG Productions, and we hired on Carson Ulrich and Ken Fournier to be our guys on the ground to do an investigation and hopefully a rescue of Cody Roman Dial. And we filmed it all, and that was done by Nat Geo TV, and it's a 6-part series that you can see on natgeo.com, and also I believe it's available on Hulu.
You know, with this show, it was incredibly compelling, and it's great to get both Carson and Ken in the studio with us at the same time to talk about the ins and outs of it, the investigation and what went on. And obviously some of the things that were seen we can talk about, but some of the things that happened off camera too, what some of our listeners are asking about. Can you just say a little bit about victimology, a bit about Cody and who he was and his age and the family that he was from?
Yes, yeah, certainly. He's 26 years old, and he was on a solo expedition of Central America, of all the national parks. And I believe he was around 6+ months into this journey. I mean, he had been gone for a while. He's been through Mexico and Guatemala, and he was going to finish his trip in Panama. And so Costa Rica was the last country he was going to visit before going into Panama and coming back home. And he is the son of Roman Dial, who is a royalty figure within the adventure race community, like the Eco Challenge and the Alaska Wilderness Race. I'm not sure the exact name for it. He's also a contributor to National Geographic. But he's raised in an environment where there is an expertise in environmental adventure and being outside. And he was navigating by compass, and he lived very off the grid with very little resources. And basically what he could carry on his back is what he took with him.
So no GPS?
No GPS that we were aware of and that Roman was aware of. He used a compass, and anything electronic was basically the internet cafe in town where he would communicate via email to his dad, mom.
And when he was younger, I mean, he was always doing sort of excursions and adventures with his dad. So his dad kind of taught him well. So, you know, when we think about risk, about, a young boy, you know, he's not that young. He's in his 20s going into the jungle. You know, he knows what he's doing, basically, doesn't he? But it's still a dangerous place.
It is. And Roman was very sensitive to the analogy of into the wild, where the young man went out and out of ignorance just perished. The narrative at the time in Costa Rica was, in all the publications and papers, was an American goes into the jungle without a guide, off trail, and perishes. And they were very sensitive against that narrative. That was one of the things they did not believe happened, and that their son would get lost in the jungle and very unlikely that he would die of some type of ecology within the jungle. And they believed it was foul play, and they wanted us to assist in that investigation.
And I guess they may have felt even more that way, given the fact that they got resistance from the authorities as well, that something else had gone on.
Yeah, it was more of indifference. There was really a year-long effort to look for him, and no one had any more energy to do anything more than Roman and Peggy. And they had exhausted all of their resources. So the likelihood of us coming in, just two guys, and solving this, I don't believe anyone thought we had a chance except Ken and I. And there's also another unique aspect of Roman's personality. Roman's a PhD college professor, and working in that environment, he has a prestige. Questioning Roman isn't something in that environment I think that I imagine that he faces very often. And when you're the parent, when it's your child that's the victim, there are some tasks that are necessary that are difficult for you to do.
And just to clarify, at this point, law enforcement in that area had basically given up. Like, they were not pursuing this any longer.
Not at all.
Am I right?
And when you say they want to go in the jungle and search for their son, that was before any groundwork had been laid. There was no intelligence network, or there was no intelligence information that was reliable about where their son had gone into the jungle at that point. He had already searched the things a year before that he had heard, right?
That is true. And one of the reasons I believe they hired me was I explained to them that on my interview that searching the jungle is one aspect. You need to penetrate the society, you know, the populace around there. It's probably a criminal investigation, and you could spend 15-hour days every single day in the jungle and not uncover anything.
Right.
You really need to get a view of what the landscape of the and find out what you can from interviewing people.
Right. What about even entry, getting into the national parks? I mean, can you explain a little bit about that? Because it's not as simple as just going down there, is it? And starting an investigation.
That's true. He was running into problems getting permits and permissions to go into parts of the forest, the national park, to get in there and search. He worked with the Red Cross and other people, and eventually they told him they didn't even want him in the park anymore searching because they were worried he was either going to hurt himself or possibly get bad PR for Costa Rica. So he was kept running into stalls and roadblocks from the government and the park services as far as giving him access. At times he'd sneak in and go search all the places he could on his own.
So you basically had provided him with a way of getting in there. I mean, he was meeting with roadblocks and resistance himself in trying to find out what happened to his own son.
Exactly, yeah.
When you say that the Costa Rican government was afraid of bad PR, you're talking about the fact that tourism is a huge industry in Costa Rica, right? And they the government did not want any bad news getting out about it being dangerous for tourists down there. Isn't that correct?
That is true. They didn't want any extra PR or any other kind of publicity about any missing people or possible people that were, you know, in harm's way. And that's why they fought to keep it in a missing persons realm, i.e. leaving it that maybe the kid just left the country or had done any other option. They wanted to put that forward first most.
And so why don't you tell us about what you did when you hit the ground running? Like, what were the first investigative steps that you did, and what were the results of them?
Well, we wanted to touch base first and foremost with where we thought his journey would start from, at the hostel. He was residing in the hostel, so we wanted to talk to the hostel owners and determine what they could tell us about his last trip.
When you started the investigation, you started to get information. What was that information?
Well, the first information we got was from the hostel. And there was the original owner of the hostel, a character, Doña Berta, who was very resistant, did not want to talk to us, minimized in almost everything she said. And then I believe it's her daughter and the daughter's husband that run it now. So we spoke to the daughter and the husband, and then we eventually found Doña Berta, and they gave us key pieces of information.
What information?
Well, when we spoke to the daughter, she made it clear. She made it clear that she wasn't there when Cody was there, but she is aware of what happened through what Doña Berta said. And Doña Berta said that, according to the daughter, that Cody was there. He went into the jungle, returned. He said, I'm going to leave for a day. Don't give up my bed. And he went on a short journey. But that the person that he left was not a guide. And when we asked her the name of the person, she wouldn't say it. And then we asked kind of like, it's off camera. It's an unofficial interview and it didn't make post-production. Was it Patalora? She kind of like, yeah. She nodded her head like, yes, that's it. So when we interviewed Doña Berta, she denies seeing who it was. But we firmly believe, because when we finish interviewing Doña Berta, she begins to yell at us in a very antagonistic tone. And she says, you all know who it was. Everyone knows who it was, but you won't do anything about it. But on camera, she did reveal that Cody went on a trip, a multi-day trip, returned from the jungle, left, said, I'll be back tomorrow night. Don't give up my bed. And he never returned. And what's significant about that is that the theory that he met with Jenkins and then perished, you know, like the next day, doesn't hold water. And there are probably four or five pieces of evidence that we could show where that theory doesn't work.
Well, could you just explain who Jenkins is and that theory, please?
Roman had found out Jenkins was probably the last person to see Cody alive from all the people he was able to interview. And so we went up there and met with him and interviewed him. And he seemed like a very straight up, decent guy with a family. So we didn't feel even initially that there was any nefarious tone to anything he had to say. So we hiked into the jungle with him to the exact location where he saw Cody, and he gave the best description he could as far as what he saw, what equipment Cody had, and what Cody had said at the time his plan was going to be. Jenkins was a miner, and you know, to support his family, he'd go into the jungle for a week or two at a time and pan for gold in different parts of, not necessarily in the park or outside the park, but around those areas, and he knew the jungle very well. And the part that Jenkins claims that he saw him in was an area that they don't usually see gringos hiking through. So it was odd when he first saw him. Okay. And that's why he stopped and actually queried him if he was all right and what his plan was.
Okay, so that was a very specific point of contact.
Yeah, and just to explain a little bit about the timing of the discovery of the backpack as well.
One of the things that the Dials prided themselves in was knowing their son and having specific details with respect to his inventory of items, what he had. So when the backpack was turned over to us by the embassy, they even say that this represents almost everything he had, except the shirt on his back and the shoes on his feet.
But the embassy held that. They held the backpack, didn't they, for 6 months? And wasn't it that on July the 1st, just as you were about to head down to Costa Rica, and Roman with the production crew, wasn't it then that you found out that the embassy had one of Cody's backpacks?
Yes. There was a bodega, which is like a storage room in the hostel. And when Cody went missing, the hostel owners, about a couple months after he went missing, found this backpack, and they believed it to be Cody's. And so they turned it over to OIJOTA, which is the Costa Rican version of their FBI. And they held on to it for months and months, and did not disclose that to anyone until one day one of the consulate members of the embassy visited them, and they said, hey, by the way, we had this backpack.
Which is crazy. I mean, they knew the family was searching, right? And they knew they were trying to get answers, and they sat on the fact that they had this backpack.
That epitomizes bureaucratic indifference, is what it is. And I don't believe it's a nefarious cover-up. I just think it's a lack of assumed role or responsibility. And the pack just sat there. And then when they gave it to the embassy had it for over 2 months. And they may not have ever told the Dials that they had it, except when it was disclosed to the embassy that a show was going to come down and film the investigation.
And that's what I was going to ask you, the timing, that they found out that there was going to be a TV show, and it's thereafter that they disclosed that they had this backpack.
The show is powerful. It's powerful in that it does elicit action on the part of the people involved. In this case, the embassy. Yes, the embassy's identifying, hey, we got this backpack. At some point, we got to give it back to the family. Why don't we tell them, hey, we have the backpack? And then when you ask, well, how long has it been in governmental possession, both Costa Rican and U.S. government? It's like 6-7 months.
So coming up, Carson and Ken talk about victimology of Cody Dial.
There is stories that he went in the jungle with gold miners.
I'm the witcho!
Muy malos personas.
The miners is crazy.
I heard that there was a tunnel up here with a bad smell.
Okay, so now we're back with Ken and Carson. So I think one of the most moving scenes for me in the whole series is when the Dials and you guys touch and look at that backpack. I mean, it was so emotional for me because it's like the closest that they'd been to their son in so long, and just seeing his clothes. I mean, I think his mother takes out a pair of shorts, and I just think that must, what was that like in the room at the time?
It was a touching moment that here there is their son's actual last belongings that he owned. that we're seen with. So it was tough, yeah.
And was any of that equipment, was that any of the equipment that was described by the guy on the previous hike that ran into him?
Yeah, the guy Jenkins, when he described it, it was pretty much to the T, the equipment that we pulled out of that pack that was then stored at the bodega.
I mean, within this actual pack, wasn't it the blue jet boil stove? Wasn't that contained within it, which was the stove that the miner saw Cody making,
yes,
or boiling something on that placed him in the jungle? And it was with that stove and that pack.
Yeah, that's a very good question, because when we first interviewed Jenkins, Peggy thought that Jenkins might be involved because he avoided eye contact with her when they spoke to him before our arrival. And when we interviewed him, there was no evasiveness. He was extremely credible. He had key pieces of information that he would only have if, in fact, he saw Cody. And one of those was he described the pack almost identical, and he described the stove. And the stove is like electric blue. It's unique. And he said green backpack, green pants, blue stove. That's what I remember, basically. I don't remember much other detail. And he remembers that the young man referred to himself as Roman.
And did you, I know because I've seen the show, that you followed a trail and you talked to somebody who picked up, you know, sort of a taxi service guy, and he picked up Cody and somebody else and dropped them off somewhere. Can you tell us about that part?
And so we spoke to the cab driver, which is, that interview is on film. And we also spoke to the Colectivo driver, and he corroborates everything. He says, yes, I remember Cody coming out. He walked up, and he had this guy, he had Pataloro with him. And they wanted to go to Dos Brazos. And the driver of the Colectivo says, I called the cab driver, and I asked him to come here. And both of their stories are identical, independent of each other.
And how did you identify that the person that took the ride from him was actually Cody Dial?
The pictures of, you know, missing pictures that had been posted of Cody is what he said. He said, that's the young man that was in the cab with me. So we naturally have to assume that there could be error there. And so we're looking for additional corroborative information or an abundance of this type of information. And we find witness after witness that sees the exact same thing.
How many, Carson, would you say?
In excess of 20.
There's stories of some, quote, other gringo that had been hiking through. And I believe that Roman Dahl believes that if Pata Dolora did go into the woods or the jungle with somebody, a white young boy, that it was this other gringo. Can you tell us about that?
That's single sourced. That comes from one person's mouth.
And
a person that?
That
we believe has a reason to conceal or hide something. And that's Pata Dolora. He's the only person that says it was Zach. And he does it in his original lie. When he speaks to the Costa Rican authorities, and when he spoke to a private investigator that was hired by the Dials, he uses that story. And then the number of witnesses, and Pata Dolora knows how many people saw him together, makes it very unlikely that he can use that as an alibi, if you will.
So I just want to
That story, we never hear it. The word Zach or another gringo in our entire time in Costa Rica never once comes up.
But Roman said that he didn't think the descriptions matched his son, and said that the backpacker seen with Pata Dolora had been smoking pot and carrying a lot of money and was wearing Crocs, and his son would never have worn Crocs or carried that amount of money or wouldn't have smoked pot, because he said he knew his son so well, and he certainly wouldn't have carried GPS.
And we have to take all that into consideration. And Roman actually swayed us that we were on the wrong path early on. But if we're looking at the possibility that we're speaking to someone that killed him or was with him on his last moments alive, is it unrealistic that he's going to lie about other aspects? So I say it on the show. I believe everything that Pata Dolora tells us about being with Cody up until the point of his death is the truth. And everything subsequent to that is a lie.
Just to paint the picture for our listeners who haven't seen the show yet.
They should definitely go see it.
Yeah, they should definitely go see it. And I know that we're throwing around a lot of names, and I just want to make sure everybody knows who we're talking about. This Pata de Lara guy, boy, if I were casting the role of the sleaziest, most dangerous looking person, I would definitely cast this guy. I mean, there's something about him that is very...
He's got that faraway stare.
Yeah, but when we're around Pata de Lara, Ken and I are very careful. For one thing, when we act in front of him in a certain way, what we think and how we act in front of him is totally different. We catalog everything he's saying. But we're very careful never to use the words kill or murder. That only comes up from Pata de Lara, and he says it over and over and over. I didn't kill him. I wouldn't kill anyone. I'm a good boy. We never use that word. It's only him that says it.
He is incongruent, and he is manipulative and is a pathological liar without a doubt.
Well, we all seen, Carson, right, in investigations where that's like the norm. When we're dealing with people who are bad, they don't have any like high level of integrity, and they will say what they think they have to say to appease the person they're with, but also to make sure that they get out of any trouble they might be in. And so it's very common that we have to actually sort of, you know, sort of go in and out of what they're saying, you know, assess the truth of different parts of it, and we try to corroborate parts. And those things that we can't corroborate, we don't put very high on a list of credibility. But the ones that we can corroborate, especially 20 times over, those things we do believe.
Right. All those witnesses seeing him with Cody. And what's the chances they're all mistaken or they've all made it up? So many.
Yeah, I don't subscribe to mass hallucination. We were conducting an investigation as part of a production for a television show. We had no authority. We had no arrest power. We could not conduct a true custodial interrogation. So we had to keep this guy around us and keep him talking and develop a rapport with him. And that was our best way to collect as much evidence as possible.
And how much strategizing did you and Ken do together? Just explain a little bit about that, of how much time you would spend talking about what you were doing next, or, you know, was quite a lot of it. You were just running. It was dynamic. And, you know, you built a rapport up with Ken, so you kind of knew what you were going to do next.
Right. Our physicalities kind of led to our roles as far as good cop, bad cop.
Right.
Carson's definitely a little bigger and meaner looking. And
how tall are you?
So
how tall are you,
we
Carson?
Gave him the bad cop role.
Roman said you're 10 foot tall, Carson.
Yeah, that's what I was. Yeah, I went a verification on that.
As far as our strategizing, Ken and I worked either together or independently coordinating what each other was doing for very long days, every day. We never took a day off, and we reached a crossroad. I found that becoming the advocate for the victim, as well as being the advocate for Roman, were not the same, and I had to make a choice.
Right. I mean, those two things are very distinct. And being a victim's advocate myself, you know, having coordinated and worked with many victims and been their voice in the system and worked with families when their loved ones no longer around, they're very different skill sets and different needs. And to do the two of them together at the same time is a real conflict. Absolutely.
We want only the truth. We don't want to pursue an avenue or a road or a line of investigation that we think is not taking us down the right path. But I believe in being around Roman is, this is his son. And he was told early on about Pata de Lara. And not only did he dismiss it, he outright sabotaged it. He said, "That's not my son. Stop doing that. You're going down the wrong path." And he convinced everyone to stop doing that. So as soon as we get down there, we pick up and we uncover this evidence. And Roman is not borderline. He's hostile. Roman has a big ego. That's a fact. And I would never want to attack the man. I never want to add additional grief to the family. And I'm in a precarious position because at the end of the show, they found their truth that they want. And I don't want to be the one who brings inconvenient facts that refute their truth. That was at the end. We conducted a covert investigation in Dos Brazos for as long as possible, and then began to go a little bit overt. We didn't disclose exactly what our roles were, what we were doing there when we first started. And our investigation in karate remained covert until we confronted Guicho and them, and that was really at the end.
We just say Guicho also, boy, what a face. He's a very distinct character in all this. At one moment he looks kind of, you know, avuncular, and at the next moment he looks like he's just a stone-cold killer. I mean, he really was a very hard person to...
Yeah, but yeah. the first time that you actually confronted him about whether or not his sons were involved in Cody's death, I mean, he seemed evasive. Yeah, he needed to go walk away. It's almost like he was going to cry.
Overwhelmed,
yeah,
or I mean, upset.
It just seemed to be completely false. And
I thought it was distancing. Actually, he was trying to get distance between you and him because of what you were asking him, and that was very telling for me. Actually,
yeah.
He needed to compose himself. We refer to him as a Rastafarian Charlie Manson.
That's a perfect description. Oh, my gosh.
There you go.
One thing it was a tell as well on our hike was the fact that once we stopped and started talking to Guicho and his boys, is the first time throughout the whole 10-hour hike. All previous to that, Joe was very relaxed, stop with us everywhere, talk at end about any point we wanted to know about the river. When we stopped to talk to Guicho and his gang, Joe moved down the river immediately, became very agitated, smoked probably 6 or 7 cigarettes, and kept calling out to us, telling us, hey, you know, we don't have time, we got to go, we got to move on. He really was very uncomfortable with us interviewing and talking to Guicho and the gang the first time.
And he was trying to get physical distance and move everybody on and out of there. I mean, you could see how uncomfortable he was.
Yes, extremely.
One of the things that for us as investigators was extremely significant, was our biggest break, was we recruited 3 sources to work in a proactive manner. They could tell us historical issues, historical facts, recollect conversations, and we documented those. But being able to recreate those live by having them wired and recording their conversations was a very good investigative tool for us. And we were able to, in the middle of the night, send Reuner in while he's wearing a wire and record a conversation with Wilin, which is Pata Delora's uncle. And he basically relates what Pata Delora says and tells the story about Guicho and his sons killing Cody. That was a huge break for us.
Right. And you saw what he was saying as credible and reliable.
It is very credible in that. You're talking about, we first speak to a witness and they tell us about a conversation or statements made by Wilin, a relative of our perp, who's stating that the perpetrator has admitted that he is aware of how this young man died, that the people that were involved were Guicho and his sons. And that conversation occurred almost a year prior to our arrival. And to get him to say the same thing a year later, while he is not aware that he's being recorded, is very credible.
Yeah, you're right. And that seemed to be a major break in the case. So there's a lot of behavior here that was very interesting. And one of the things that we hadn't mentioned to this point is that you and I and Ken and my brother Tim would also consult via Skype while you were in the jungle. And because one of the things that you did was present me the facts of what was going on, and then I gave you my assessment, and, you know, completely independent of yours, I think they dovetail very well, right?
No, exactly. We have very similar backgrounds. We're both 1811s, and I'm able to explain to you what we're uncovering, and then you can see exactly the relevance and the significance of that piece of evidence. And we did keep both you, Jim, and your brother apprised of everything we were doing because we valued your opinion. And we also notified the authorities. Mm-hmm. You know, through you and your brother, we notified the FBI, and we kept the Costa Rican authorities abreast of everything we were doing.
All right. We're gonna get into that in greater detail. We got to take a break right now and hear from our sponsors, And then we'll come back and talk about how the investigation went from there.
They call him Pata de Lora.
Is he dangerous?
Yes, very.
I'll be surprised if he's this calculating.
What other possibility could it be?
All right, we're back from break, and this is Real Crime Profiler. We're talking to Carson Ulrich and Ken Fournier, both stars of the Nat Geo series Missing Dial. And we're at the point of the story where we are talking about the fact that Pata de Lora, also known as Joe or Jose, had basically accused Guicho and his sons of ambushing and killing Cody Dial.
Well, when we recorded the conversation with Willeen, we felt that was a key piece of evidence. And we felt it was time to bring Oihoda in. And we wanted them to be part of the interrogation, not in an active role, but to listen to the interrogation real time.
And by Oihoda, you mean the OIJ, which is their version of the FBI, right?
That is correct.
Okay.
And we knew that it's a real possibility. Once we went from, we'll say, fun and games and a National Geographic film crew to a real confrontational interrogation, that it's very likely that Pata de Lora would simply say, I don't want to play anymore. I'm going to leave. And we wanted the OIJ investigators outside to have heard enough from the interrogation and to heard the recording of Willeen and maybe actually be in a position to act. And we could fail and take our investigation as far as it could possibly go with a failed interrogation. And that was a very likely outcome for us. We knew that going in. But we did succeed in the interrogation, and Oihoda gave us the Heisman. Our entire time there, he never got involved. They had excuse, or they had reasons, or they had issues with rules of evidence that precluded their involvement. And so we acted alone. And I did not want to conduct the interrogation alone, but we were at the point where we had to go for broke. We had to give it our best shot. So the day of the interrogation, the day before, I had explained in detail the admissions made by Willeen, recorded, and who recorded them and under what circumstances they were recorded, and our intention to interrogate Pata de Lora. And we wanted to include them. And then when they arrived with a fiscal, which is a prosecutor, and they said no. The only way we can interview him is in a custodial interview at our office. And so they said, we cannot participate in that. And they actually got mad when they saw I had a microphone on. And I had been around them before. And they asked me if I had a microphone on. I said, I did. Yeah, we work for National Geographic. They're filming this. And they scurried away. And what is not known to the show is they went and got a denuncia, an arrest warrant for me.
Well, that's because it's actually illegal to tape officials like that, and it's illegal for them to be a participant of a show. So it's kind of something you didn't know, obviously, but obviously they were very sensitive to, and they certainly didn't want to get into, you know, legal trouble themselves. But nevertheless, you gave them, you shared with them the information. Didn't you give them access to Pata de Lora? Didn't he sit down with them and get interviewed by them?
Yes, that was later on. We insisted that Pata de Lora go and make a denuncia, a declaration, to the fiscal, to the prosecutor's office, and tell them the same thing he told us. He did that, and they opened a criminal investigation as a result. They opened a murder investigation.
So they changed it from missing person to a murder investigation based on what Pata de Lora told them.
That is true.
So that's another very significant point in your investigation and moving the needle, certainly with the authorities, of getting them to be open to the fact that they're, you know, that this is an unexplained death.
Yeah, let me just address that. So there are, what makes the show dramatic, and it, some of it's done in the editing, and some of it's done in the directing or producers on the producing of it, is like there's this other theory that there's a Zach, and that Cody wasn't killed and that Ponta de Lora was never with him. Ponta de Lora never denies it. And there is this evasive and there's this fear and there's this anxiety about him that no other witness that we talked to has. Why would he admit to being with this young man if, in fact, he wasn't? Furthermore, why would he go and make a legal sworn statement to a prosecutor that he was with him if he was not? Those are my questions. And so, I mean, it's for me, in my investigation and looking at it, it's clear he was with him. And the idea that that Ponta de Lora was never with Cody is it's crazy. Given the number of witnesses and given the cooperation of Ponta de Lora, and he's in a forced cooperation because there's three lies that Ponta de Lora says. His first lie is that I wasn't with Cody, I was with Zach. But given the number of witnesses, he cannot stay on that course of action. His second lie is, yes, I was with Cody, but we safely made it back to Puerto Jimenez. And under interrogation, we break that lie. And he tells what I now believe to be the third lie. Okay, we didn't come back to Puerto Jimenez, but I saw him get grabbed by these miners, Huicho, and his sons. All of these lies, or all three lies, that conceal what had happened to Cody after he was killed.
So if the third one is a lie about Huicho, why is he so afraid when you guys run into Huicho? Why is he, why is that, you know, such an intense moment? And why is he staying away?
Well, we're not sure that there wasn't a, you know, part of Joe's story that was the untrue is possibly that he was an accomplice in what happened to him. So, and that's the part of dissecting everything that Joe has to say and finding out what parts are truth and what parts are lies to cover up what he did do or didn't do. And there's a good component possibly that he was actually in cohorts with the Huicho gang when this all went down with Cody. And so he wanted to hide that from us as well.
I mean, he certainly seemed to be very uncomfortable when the cadaver dogs came on the scene as well. He was asking a lot of questions, wasn't he, about the detail
how
and
deep
how they...
can they smell?
There are things that we know now that we did not know then that are extremely significant.
So why don't you tell us what?
Yeah.
So the idea that when he is telling this Huicho story in great detail, we are thinking either this is a lie and he is making up a third false ending, or it is true. And if it's another lie, then it's there's a reason he's making this a lie to hide something else.
Roman talked to this guy, and this guy said that Ponta de Lora had confessed to him that he killed Cody, right?
That is correct.
And then what did he say he did with the body?
He did not say, but Roman was convinced that his son was killed, and he was probably killed by Ponta de Lora, or Ponta de Lora and Huicho, or you know, one of the two killed him.
That seems to be the evidence that you were able to uncover. That is
what it pointed to. Yeah.
Yeah, it was one of the two, and the only independent, we had no information about Huicho and his sons other than from Ponta de Lora. There was no other independent information that linked Huicho and his sons.
Right.
So it was either true or it was a lie.
And when you confronted Huicho and his sons with Ponta de Lora there, they pointed the finger at Ponta de Lora, didn't they?
Yes. Then they acted very evasive. They acted very sketchy because these are some heinous individuals. There's like a natural guilt. If someone's killed, they probably believe, oh, we are involved ourselves, whether it's true or not, because they represent the majority of evil in that area.
But and going back to that meeting, I mean, you were in the middle of, you know, you've got the family there, you've got Roman and Peggy, you've got Ponta de Lora, and then you've got Huicho and his sons, and you're sort of in the middle of it, and then you've got cameras as well. It was very
so
intense.
I was on the edge of my seat when I saw that. It was just, ugh.
So how did you feel? I mean, what was going down for you actually there and then at the time? I mean, did it feel volatile? I mean, having a crew there as well, did it actually feel volatile to both of you or not?
It was. I was against it at first. And when they brought the idea up, I got very angry over it. And the reason I said you are a bunch of television people. you want to make a show and you're going to create a tsunami and you don't really care about the results. You've never had an informant killed.
Right.
You're assuming no responsibility in protecting these people. You just want to make a good show. And I got very angry.
Well,
but then I thought about it and I felt that it had investigative value. And I also felt that the bigger the story was in getting that footage and the more people knew about it, it actually in some ways protected Joe as a witness, because if anyone was going to hurt him, everyone in the world would think it would be these guys.
Right.
I think you're right that there is some level of protection in that, because the confrontation was on camera and everybody who was in that confrontation knew it was on camera, is sort of also a layer of protection.
That's correct.
So why don't we move on to now? You've wrapped the production. Ken, you went with Roman Dahl to Washington, D.C. to meet with the FBI director. Can you tell us about that?
Just prior to that meeting in D.C., Roman had received a call from down in Costa Rica, but he wasn't able to call it back till right after the meeting. When he called that meeting, that's when we were notified by the embassy down there that they had actually found a body and believed that it might possibly be Cody. So the two of us scrambled, and then the very next morning, we flew down to Costa Rica in attempts to try and get down there, because we knew the Oihota was going into the jungle to see this site, this sighting or this location where they claimed the body might be. And we wanted to be there as soon as we could to try and see exactly what they were finding.
Okay, so a couple of weeks into the investigation, when you guys are boots on the ground, is when you actually find out that the backpack that has been missing for a year and a half was actually, or almost 2 years, was actually sitting in a storage room for 6 months, and it had been in the possession of the embassy for 2 months. And then just days before the series begins to air, this body that's been missing for 2 years miraculously shows up.
Someone stumbles upon it and the camping gear.
Yeah. Tell us about that.
I'm not sure of the motivation, but 2 weeks prior to that, I had talked to Roman and Peggy, and I had felt that I wanted to take one more shot at Joe and try and get any information we could get out of him, because I still felt he had a story to tell and he knew more that he was holding. So I flew down there on my own and spent 3 or 4 days with Joe in trying to convince him that, look, hey, the parents just want the resolution with this. They just want to bring their son home. They just want that information. And we went back up into the jungle because Joe changed his story at that point and said that he believed he knew where the body was. He thought he could lead us to it. We left it real light. I didn't want to put pressure on him how he knew, but we actually went up into the jungle. And at one point, I believed he was taking me into the location and was closer to where they actually did find the body. But something switched in him. He got cold feet and went back out, left the jungle. And he said, I got to go back out there. I got to do this on my own. I know this has to be solved. It's going to be haunting me my whole life until I solve this. And I told him, Joe, if he's not the first one to find this evidence, if the Guicho gang finds it before him, they'll be able to put that in.
Yeah.
Let me point out something very significant is they're not looking on the coast in Karate. They're looking in the middle of the jungle. So about halfway through the trip, they're looking for the body, meaning it never made it to Karate. That is extremely significant, because it's unlikely that Guicho and them would kill him and then carry the body 5 hours into the jungle where it lays. So at this point, there are some very significant aspects of how the body is revealed that it's found. There is a story that is stated by the Oihota that a Manai, a forest ranger, wished to take the weekend off and go into the jungle and search for this body within 24 hours of the airing of the show. I believe there's three facts that all are directly related to the discovery of the body. The show is about to air. It's within 24 hours. There's a $50,000 reward and knowledge of where the body is. Someone who knew where it was had to assist. Without those three things, the body doesn't show up at that time, because this story that a forest ranger who took the weekend off so that he could collect the $50,000.
In other words, if he was working for the Forest Ranger Service, he would not be able to collect the money if he found the body then.
Right.
So
there's
a
2-year. Yes, that's correct. There's a 2-year period where the body's not found. So he's going to take a weekend off and go into the jungle and says he's going to go look for the body and comes back and finds it.
Now, so, is this an area that had been searched before?
Yes, Roman had been in that area, very close to there. In fact, it's really hard for him once we got up there that to realize how close he had gotten to that area where the body was found, and it just kind of just had not been in that one location.
But the fact is, I mean, I've seen the pictures, and, you know, there's some gear that doesn't look like it's been laying in a jungle getting rained on and everything for 2 years.
Or perished in any way.
Yeah, and when we say body, the fact is it was 3 bones, right?
2 femurs and a skull.
Yeah, 2 femurs and a skull. Where are the other 203 bones from that body? I mean, the vast majority of that body is not there. And to say that's all that's left, I mean, I've done, and my unit has done research on how, if a body is left decomposing in the wild, how that gets spread out by critters and nature and so forth. But typically, if you do a good search in that area, you'll find many more bones than just 3. And why, like, for example, why weren't the hip bones found? I mean, that is a massive bone in the human body. It's bigger than the skull. And why wasn't that found? It's just strange belief and credibility to think that just disappeared.
Well, extreme frustration to our point. We immediately scrambled to fly down there to try and catch up with them because we knew they were going back into the jungle. And we hit the trail the very next morning, and they had about a 12-hour window ahead of us. They had gotten in there. And by the time we got to a close location, it was up on a ridge above from the actual location. The Oihota and the park rangers then shut down any ability of us that represented National Geographic to go down to the site. They did allow the dad to go down to the actual site, but in his hike down to there, the whole crew of the Oihota and their forensic specialist was already hiking back out with what they thought they had of all the evidence of the body and any kind of natural material from Cody.
But nobody else went down there as a specialist. They just brought everything back up that they recovered.
Right. We have to ask ourselves, what are the motivations of all of these parties? So why would they create a false narrative that a miner found, I mean, that a ranger found it, when in fact it was a miner? It wasn't a ranger that found the body. Why would they create a false narrative that a tree fell on them? And Roman ate that up. Roman is, that is gospel. A tree fell on my son, and you cannot convince him of anything other than that. And well, if you bring up like a question like, why is there no body parts? He doesn't want to hear it.
Well we believe what we want to believe and what we want to see, and that is a default mechanism, and that's what he chooses to believe.
Yeah. You feel for him, and he even says it. He says it on the Nightline interview, and he says it on the last episode. He wants this journey over. He doesn't want to go on with this search for justice, and his 2-year involvement, it gives him no belief or confidence that they're actually going to convict anyone. Right. And so he has his truth. He has his narrative, and he wants to live out, you know, let him live in, you know, it's his grief. It's his child. We don't want to contribute to that in any way.
Yeah. And I think that's a great point to end on, that we, as people who focus on the victims of crimes, we have to let them live their life and their narrative, and that's great.
So, and he wanted it to be a natural death, and that's what he wanted to believe, so that all the other things they didn't have to deal with. And maybe that is just the psychological, you know, psyche's way of coping with things, but I'm sure he does reflect on some of these things that don't fit as well. Maybe not now, but certainly in the future.
Yeah. All right. Well, we really want to thank you, Carson and Ken, for coming on the show, and we will maybe have you back again. And I hope that that you guys get involved in other investigations and that you have just as much success, because you certainly brought this case to a conclusion. And I don't believe it would have been unless you guys were out there in the jungle. Thanks.
You did a great job. And thank you for sharing your experience with us. Thank you.
Bye, guys.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're signing off now from Real Crime Profile. See you next time.
So if you enjoy our podcast and would like to support us, there are a couple of important things you can do. First, you can go over to iTunes and give us a positive 5-star review. You can check out our sponsors and take advantage of the special promotions for Real Crime Profile listeners. You can go over and like our Facebook page, and you can follow us on Twitter. But most importantly, you can share our podcast with friends, family, and anyone you know would be interested in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes. So thank you for listening.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineered by Terrell Parham. Music composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, safety, shelter or counselling, call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, 214-946-4357, or go on their website www.genesisshelter.org or the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.
If you're a regular listener to the show, you know we have great brands like Blue Apron, Audible, and Casper advertising with us, and they keep coming back because our listeners really respond to them, which we're really thankful for. Well, if you happen to own a business or manage the advertising buy for one, then you should consider advertising on Real Crime Profile. Podcast advertising is on the rise, and it's one of the most effective ways of reaching consumers on the go today. So please go to wondery.com/advertisers. Again, it's wondery.com/advertisers. And get in touch with us. Thanks.